This is Between the Lines without the intro outro music, part 4 of the Father Guido Sarducci School of Geopolitics. I say a resource, you say divide and rule, we say holistic. Reading from Mark Curtis's book published by Serpent's Tail, Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam. And again, even more timely with all the backlash with Trump's so-called Muslim immigration ban. So we're up to chapter 6, in quotes, handy weapons in Jordan and Egypt. British foreign policy planners were confronted with a plethora of difficult tasks in the early 1970s, notably joining the European Economic Community on favorable terms, helping its principal ally, the U.S., extricate itself from its brutal Vietnam War with less than total humiliation, promoting détente with the Soviet Union while preserving Western military superiority, and fighting off demands from developing countries for a new international economic order, a call by developing countries to establish a more equitable international trade system. A Foreign Office paper of 1974 entitled Potential Problems in British Foreign Policy considered the ongoing challenge of nationalism, understood as meaning that most countries in the developing world were, quote, keen to assert their national identity and independence in both political and economic contexts, end quote. This rising trend allowed countries opposing the practices and rules largely laid down by the wealthy countries of the West. An additional problem, however, was the weakness of the West, and that the ability of Western countries to exercise pressure in the Third World is much reduced. Few countries, apart from the U.S., possess the means to impose their will by force, and public opinion, in general, gives little support to, quote, overseas adventures, end quote, it noted. The report was written following the quadrupling of oil prices during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, which plunged Britain into economic crisis but propelled the largest oil producer, Saudi Arabia, into a position of global power. The Saudi rulers used their stupendous new fortunes to further champion the preeminence of Wahhabi fundamentalism within global Islam, which contributed to the emergence during the 1970s of militant Islamist groups in most of the world's Muslim nations. By the decade's end, not only was Sunni Islamic radicalism a major political force, but Shia radicalism had driven Iran's Islamic Revolution, overthrowing the Western-backed Shah and further challenging Western hegemony over Middle Eastern oil. The resurgence of radical Islam presented British foreign policy planners with both threats and opportunities, and the record suggests that they often saw the opportunities as greater. After 1973, a British government becoming ever weaker on the world stage forged a still deeper new alliance with Saudi Arabia. Yet the beginning of this tumultuous decade began with two other episodes showing how the interests of British policymakers could coincide with those of Islamist forces. That's the first page or so of that chapter. And it goes on to the Brotherhood. Let's see, on the same side as the Brotherhood, again, in September 1970, the pro-British CIA-funded King of Jordan, Hussein, narrowly avoided being overthrown by Palestinian radicals. His survival was due to a familiar combination of forces, the British and American governments and the Muslim Brotherhood, and dealt another body blow to the cause of Arab nationalism. Black September, as it became known, was a bloody confrontation between Jordanian government forces and Palestinian guerrillas, who were a mixture of Nasserite nationalists, Marxist groups, and members of Yasser Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. So many different factions. Then later on, he mentions pro-Syrian Ba'athist forces and pro-Egyptian Nasserites. A reference to President Assad, which I think must be the father of the current Bashar Assad. And here is made note, according to McLean, King Hussein told him that Nasser's death in September 1970 had created a vacuum in the Middle East, and Jordan, with British and American help, could play a constructive part in bringing to power reasonable governments in both Iraq and Syria. fairly often in the book, he says, stuff like here. He says it may not have been a coincidence, and, you know, some report showed or seemed to indicate. So a lot of the information is not always definite, but then typically within a page, he will back up something that is pretty clear or give a quote or, you know, an arms funding or some action that, you know, it shows whether it's full-blown participation or, you know, guilt in the issue is maybe not sure, but it sure shows a clear evidence is presented in the book as witnessed by pages of footnotes. Let's see, is actually 20, like 30, 40, 50, something, 50, 60 pages of footnotes. So, like Elon Papp's book, Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, this guy did his homework. And yeah, here's an example of the ongoing. Not only is it divide and conquer, but it's, you know, backing of both sides. This apparent incongruity. Britain's rule in propping up King Hussein's regime in Jordan sits rather oddly with acquiescing in the supply of arms and training to a terrorist group bent on overthrowing him. Even if this was apparently motivated by other factors, in other words, monitoring terrorist financing and arms deliveries to the IRA. This apparent incongruence seems less odd, however, in light of various other episodes where London has also backed both sides in conflicts, such as in the Hussein ibn Saud conflict in Arabia in the 1920s, the Arab-Israeli conflict in Palestine from 1920 until 1948, and others we will come to later. So here's where, you know, the references to the 1920s, that's almost 100 years. So here it shows the empire modus operandi going on. There's a section called Islamizing Egypt. As King Hussein was crushing the Palestinians in September 1970, Anwar Sadat, Nasser's vice president, took over as president of Egypt on Nasser's death. The Muslim Brotherhood's decision to side with King Hussein in the Jordan crisis did not go unnoticed by the new Egyptian president, who had strong personal links to the Brotherhood going back to the 1940s. As president, Sadat rejected Nasser's Arab nationalism, purged the government of Nasserites, and expelled Soviet military advisors in 1972. Instead, Sadat's strategy was to Islamicize Egyptian society and forge a new alliance with the U.S. Washington was so keen to work with Sadat in bringing Egypt over to the U.S. side in the Cold War that policymakers and intelligence officers viewed his restoration of the Islamic right benignly or tacitly encouraged it. In fact, Sadat's policies helped spark the emergence of global Islamic radicalism. For Britain as well as the U.S., this was a case of the chickens coming home to roost. The British had connived with Islamist forces against Nasser, their chief Middle Eastern enemy for the previous 18 years, and helped to defeat Arab nationalism as a major political force. Now, Whitehall joined the U.S. in backing Sadat as he swung Egypt into a new Islamic as well as pro-Western path, understanding that the regime was not very democratic, as the British ambassador noted in 1975, but welcoming it as a, quote, moderate, unquote, stabilizing force in the region. It was anything but. Sadat's broad Islamization of Egyptian society included enshrining Islam as the state religion in the 1971 constitution and reversing Nasser's policy towards the Muslim Brotherhood, releasing some brothers from jail and declaring a general amnesty for all those imprisoned before May of 71. By the mid-70s, Sadat, with the support of the Saudis, was allowing Muslim brothers to return from their Nasser-imposed exile in Saudi Arabia, where many of them had grown rich. The Muslim brothers, freed by Sadat, gravitated towards Egypt's universities, many of which were, by the early 1970s, controlled by Islamist movements, which had overturned the dominance of nationalist ideology. At the same time, the Islamist intelligentsia on the campuses began to spread their ideas throughout the Muslim world, courtesy of the networks and financial clout of the Saudi Wahhabis, especially following the 1973 Arab-Israeli conflict. Among the new recruits to the movement were two important social groups, the mass of young urban poor from deprived backgrounds, and the devout bourgeois, a class hitherto excluded from political power and restricted by military and monarchical regimes. Read that one again. Among the new recruits of the movement were two important social groups, the mass of young urban poor from deprived backgrounds. That reminds of a lot of the right-wing, neo-Nazi kind of groups and recent history in Europe and elsewhere. And even the, Trump appealing to the poor in the Midwest, but, a little bit different. And the devout bourgeoisie, a class hitherto excluded from political power. So I don't know if that could be comparable to the lefty liberals, but anyway. And towards the end of this chapter, Sadat's belief that he could manage and co-opt the Muslim Brotherhood against his leftist and communist political opponents worked to an extent. But the Brotherhood refused to openly back the regime, not least since Sadat refused to allow it to operate as a political party. So tangled. All these preferences and who's doing what. Sadat also failed to understand that only a complete Islamization of society could satisfy the demands of the more fundamentalist groups. In the October 1973 Arab-Israeli War, when the Arab states led by Egypt made early territorial gains against the Israeli military before reaching a stalemate, Sadat deployed the symbols of Islam to fire Egypt, in contrast to Nasser's evocation of Arab nationalism in the 1967 war. But Sadat's overtures to Israel and the signing of the Camp David Accords in September 1978, which led to a peace treaty with Israel, confirmed to the radical Islamists bent on Israel's destruction that Sadat was clearly no ally. His earlier patronage of the militant Islamists had by now led to the formation of a violent jihadist movement in the country. Sadat realized the threat against the regime too late. It was only in 1981 that the regime cracked down on the Jamaat Islamiyya, dissolving them in September. The following month, Sadat was assassinated by the Al-Jihad organization, which had its roots in a university Islamic group at Assiut University in Upper Egypt, similar to those formed with government help earlier in the decade. In the 80s, members of Al-Jihad were to splinter off into other groups, notably Islamic Jihad, led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, whose militants would volunteer for the war in Afghanistan. Though many of their members and leaders were, like al-Zawahiri, former Muslim brothers, these more violent organizations had become distinct from the Brotherhood. They attacked the Brotherhood for its lack of militancy and for accepting some notions of democracy rather than subjecting all powers of the state to Allah's will. Violent Islamism now appeared to be on the march. Sadat's assassination was a blow to U.S. and British strategy in the Middle East, but his Islamization program in Egypt was already proving useful to one major Anglo-American covert operation. It was the radicalized Islamist elements from Egypt who were among those volunteering to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan after 1979, and who played key leadership roles there, sponsored by the Sadat regime and aided by Saudi money. Thus, these forces continued to be the handy weapon recognized by British officials, though far beyond Egypt itself. But before turning to these later events, we consider the momentous events of 1973 and the deepening and rather extraordinary British-Saudi alliance. Chapter 7, The Saudi and Iranian Revolutions. On the eve of October 1973, Arab-Israeli War, Britain's position in the Middle East was seen as being comparatively rosy compared to the bad old days of Arab nationalism. After Nasser's anti-imperialism and Sadat, which from the what we just heard was like a mixed bag of stuff. Let's see, skipping around in this chapter. After 73, the Saudi strategy of exporting Wahhabism took off exponentially. So did a new and profound British alliance with, indeed, dependency on the Saudis, which tied British economic policy inextricably to the world's preeminent Islamic fundamentalist state. So again, underpinning all of this craziness, I would say, is the resource, oil. Oil, and in some cases, the natural gas, whatever. And here's the next section, in quotes, a happy new era. The armies of Egypt and Syria began a surprise attack on Israel on October 6, 73, crossing the ceasefire lanes in the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula, which Israel had captured during the Six-Day War in 67, soon after the attack. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, led by the Gulf states, announced a rise in the price of oil and a total embargo against the U.S. for its support of Israel. After further cuts in oil production, the price soared, more than quadrupling compared to early 1973, creating an international crisis and raising panic in Western countries. And then later on, flush with oil money, the Saudis stepped up their bankrolling of Islamic organizations and charities around the world. During the 1970s, the Saudi-controlled Muslim World League opened a raft of new offices abroad, while its Ministry for Religious Affairs printed and exported millions of Qurans free of charge and distributed Wahhabi doctrinal texts among the world's mosques. The Saudis also instigated a massive building program that would eventually construct 1,500 mosques worldwide. They have the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, all these various organizations. These British plans had actually begun before the October oil prices rise. In January 73, the Foreign Office had noted that with Saudi oil wealth and plans for industrialization in the kingdom, there was a golden opportunity for British industry and for British banking if they have the energy and imagination to grasp it. That was a quote. By the following month, it was working on initiatives to nudge Saudi thinking in the direction of sensible investment abroad of their surplus revenues, end quote, and to persuade them, quote, of the facilities that the City of London had to offer. The Saudis were clearly being seen as potential saviors for Britain, already undergoing a deep economic crisis. And I'm reminded of John Trudell's mentioning the industrial ruling class. And they have these high-level meetings, Britain and Saudi Arabia in 73. In the midst of the oil crisis in 73, Trade Secretary Peter Walker proposed to the Prime Minister to make a major effort to persuade the Arab oil producers to invest part of their large surpluses over the next five or six years in British industry. He outlined various options for partnership with them, entailing greater involvement of British industry in Saudi industrial development, especially in exploring new sources of raw materials or energy. By the end of the year, after visits to Saudi Arabia by the governor of the Bank of England and officials in the Department of Trade and Industry, Ambassador Rothney was noting that Britain and Saudi Arabia had, quote, taken the first steps towards the establishment of a new long-term relationship in the linked spheres of development, investment, and oil, end quote. So it's oil, but then it turns into, you know, oil and banking and in industry, infrastructure, whatever. And the British solution was for a new and reform system which might serve us in the future as Bretton Woods did in the past. There's a quote there, referring to the arrangements established in the mid-1940s in which countries pegged their exchange rates to the value of gold. And eventually, converting U.S. suspension of the convertibility, the mid-40s, in which countries pegged their exchange rates on the value of gold, but which collapsed in 1971 following the U.S.'s suspension of the convertibility of dollars to gold. The British now wanted to ensure that the oil producers recycled their surplus petrodollars to reinforce the stability of the system. At the same time, some of these should come our way, the Treasury implored. And further on, both states were bent on maintaining in power the pro-Western feudal sheikdoms elsewhere in Arabia. This applied firstly in Oman, O-M-A-N, where the Sultan was still fighting nationalist forces in Dhofar province with the aid of British troops and Saudi money, and secondly in North Yemen, created after the British and Saudi-backed covert war, and where a pro-Saudi military government now faced a Soviet-backed national regime in neighboring South Yemen. So there's an explanation of the North and South Yemen. Perhaps like North and South Korea, I'm not sure. In October, James Callaghan and Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Saud bin Faisal jointly agreed that the Saudis would finance North Yemen's arms imports and that the British would arrange, quote, private and, quote, counterinsurgency training for the North Yemeni regime. And here I have a note, the shift to global East-West relations, the world economic, military, monetary situation, This was now a global strategic alliance, and British planners could have had no illusions about just who the Saudis were otherwise supporting in their foreign policy. In the 1970s and early 80s, Saudi Arabia financed, among others, the Palestinian terrorist group headed by Abu Nidal, Islamic militants opposed to Gaddafi in Libya, Uganda's bloodthirsty dictator Idi Amin, Muslim rebels in the Philippines, and the brutal Siad Barre regime in Somalia. The kingdom's links with terrorist groups were known to the U.S. by the early 1970s. May of 74, for example, the U.S. State Department warned Britain not to go ahead with its reported offer to sell blowpipe surface-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia for fear of seepage of this type of weapon into the hands of terrorists. The U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia told his British counterpart that the U.S. had refused to sell similar equipment, the Red Eye, for fear of their ending up with terrorists and being used against civil aircraft or similar targets. And then further on, cultivating the Ayatollah. Iran's Islamic Revolution and the emergence of power of Ayatollah Khomeini came to pose the biggest challenge to British and U.S. power in the oil-rich Gulf region and wider Middle East since the rise of Arab nationalism in the 50s. But the record shows that Britain dropped its support for the Shah before the revolution and sought to insure itself with the Iranian opposition led by Khomeini. Once the latter was in power, Whitehall initially sought good relations with the Islamic regime and connived with it, seeing it as a counter to the Soviet Union. And then here's the foreign secretary's explanation from his memoirs. Throughout the late 1978, Britain was still backing the Shah to restore order, but ideally hoped to replace him with a military or other figure. And now here's the quote. "We needed someone with charisma who would only be in post for a few years, brave enough to make enemies, and ready later to step aside for the Shah's son as a constitutional monarch." And further on, the following month, an Islamic Republic was declared with a new constitution reflecting the ideals of the theocracy. It gets into bits about Margaret Thatcher. Thatcher was here upholding the Iranian theocracy as a counter to Soviet expansion and saw a united Iran as a deterrent to it. Thatcher's thinking appeared to mirror that of President Carter's national security advisor, however you pronounce his name, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Amidst the upheaval in Iran towards the end of 1978, Brzezinski had begun to press the idea in Washington that the region from Northeast Africa through the Gulf to Central Asia was an arc of crisis, and to argue for what he called a new security framework to reassert U.S. power and influence in the region. Brzezinski envisioned deepening U.S. military ties with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Turkey, and other Muslim countries near the southern borders of the Soviet Union and in the Gulf region, and mobilizing Islamic forces to contain the Soviet Union. Once the Shah had gone, this thinking took on even greater importance, and by the summer of 79, Brzezinski wanted a de facto alliance with the forces of Islamic resurgence and with the regime of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In the words of Richard Khatam, the CIA officer who had played a key role in the 1953 Iran coup, that was the quote there. Brzezinski met Prime Minister Bazargan in Algiers a few months later to advance the policy, but it was completely halted once the hostage crisis began in November. Thatcher, however, continued to evoke the idea of Islamic Iran being a counter to the Soviets after the hostage crisis had begun. Yeah, might as well read the last page here of this chapter. Britain's de facto support for the Iranian Islamists was, however, not merely passive and rhetorical. In 1982, when Khomeini's regime had stepped up its repression and execution of political opponents, Britain engaged in an extraordinary act of connivance with it by helping it nearly destroy the communist Tudeh, T-U-D-E-H party, the main leftist organization in the country. After initially collaborating with the Islamic regime, Tudeh withdrew its support in 1982, criticizing it for continuing the war with Iraq, which had begun in 1980. The regime then sought to suppress the Tudeh, imprisoning its leaders. When Vladimir Kuzichkin, a major in the Soviet KGB, defected to Britain in 1982, he passed on to M16 a list of Soviet agents operating in Iran, following which M16 allows Kuzichkin to visit the CIA and also give it the list. In October, M16 and the CIA jointly decided to pass this list to the Iranians in order to curry favor with the Iranian regime and reduce Soviet influence in a strategically important country. Dozens of alleged agents were subsequently executed and more than 1,000 members of the two-day arrested, while the party was banned. In December, 100 members of the party's military organization were put on trial, drawing substantially on the information supplied by Britain. Several were sentenced to death. The two-day was effectively crushed, though later managed to reconstitute itself and operate as an underground movement. This episode showed that Britain was prepared to secretly collaborate with a ruthless Shia Islamist regime in pursuit of specific common interests, the repression of the left, even though Iran was by now considered a strategic threat and overall anti-Western force. This was also in line with long-standing British policy reflecting British collaboration with Ayatollah Kashani in the coup planning against Mujahideen 30 years before. Soon, Britain even restarted the export of major weapons to the Khomeini regime, as we see in Chapter 9. So that's it, Chapter 6 and 7. This is Show 162. And next up is the Chapter 8, Training in Terrorism, the Afghan Jihad. That gets into the 1980s and the Mujahideen, which would be probably the most familiar bit of this covert stuff that came out after 9/11 that most people would be familiar with. And then Chapter 9, The Dictator, the King, and the Ayatollah, the dictator in Pakistan, King of the Saudis, and the Ayatollah in Iran. So, yeah, you get to see that those two chapters we just heard, quite the tangle of spies and coups and politics and religion and yet ever the base note of oil and banking. It goes on and on, the convoluted list of stuff, but at least the book gives the gists and some of the gists and some of the roots. So that's about a third through this fascinating study again. A book by Mark Curtis, Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam. So thanks for listening and have a good one.